In a recent survey, 71% of employees couldn't even pick out their company's strategy from a multiple choice list. If most employees don't understand the strategy, how could they possibly execute on it? In today's episode, we're going to uncover what strategy really means and how leaders can move from thinking about it as just a plan to empowering their teams to make smart decisions that drive results all throughout the organization. Welcome to the Learn It All podcast, the show for today's leaders who want to get ahead and stay ahead of the game, because we know that great leaders aren't born or made, they're always in the making. I'm your host, Damon Lemby. I'm a two-time best-selling author and CEO of Learn It, a live learning platform that has helped upskill over 2 million people over the past 3 decades. I'm really excited to welcome my good friend, Tim Ohi, to the show today. Tim is a growth architect and executive coach who helps organizations transform their strategic execution. As the founder of Kopu Solutions, Tim believes that strategy isn't a plan. It's a dynamic process of decision-making where every employee understands their role because it's crystal clear in how they contribute to the larger goals of the business. I love Tim's practical examples of how companies can bring strategy to life through decision-making, how healthy conflict is really good for an organization when it's managed well, and how it can drive innovation and strengthen teams. And Tim shares a heartfelt story of the stress and grief in his personal life that he's had to go through in hopes it'll help others. Let's jump into this great conversation I have with my buddy, Tim. Tim, what is strategy really, and how should leaders think about it in today's fast-changing world?
That's a great question, because I actually think most people have the wrong answer. If you go to the dictionary and you type in, or if you're online, or you look up in an old school, in a book, the word strategy, you're often going to see the word, it's a plan to achieve a targeted outcome. Research from a guy named Henry Mintzberg out of Montreal challenged the whole idea and said strategy is a series of decisions you make in order to achieve a targeted outcome. So anybody who's been in the military knows exactly what I'm talking about, because you're already given a mission and then they say, look, here's plan A. You should have plan B, because plan A usually doesn't work the way it's planned, and you need to have the freedom and the confidence to make the decisions you need to make to, Charlie Mike, complete the mission. So when I talk about strategy, I always talk about it being a decision-making experience in order to achieve an outcome, not a plan. And I think that's actually caused a domino effect on a whole bunch of dysfunctions in the workplace now in terms of how we work. But I'll let you take us there as we go.
No, I like it. And I always go back to, I love the line by Mike Tyson where he says, everybody's got a plan, right? Until you get punched in the face.
That's right. It's like, well, that's true though. It's so true.
It's totally true.
Not that I've been in any fights, but yeah. I will say, you know, you can do everything you want. It's supposed to be one way. My son's a black belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And, you know, being a jiu-jitsu dad, go to all the tournaments and all the other stuff. I learned watching that it's, you can do everything you want in preparation for a tournament, but once you actually get on the mat with another competitor, all that goes out the door. It's all about the flow. It's all about understanding. And I think that's a skill that most business leaders might intuitively have, but it's not actually taught. It's not actually drilled into them to think, how do you maintain your flow? How do you build that flow? And more importantly, how do you make sure everybody on your team understands that concept of flow? Because if you look at people's calendars, it's meeting after meeting after meeting in order to check a Gantt chart, to look at all these different reports and dashboards that have nothing to do with making great decisions in the moment, and more about what's the update on the plan.
Yeah, I mean, it's like what you're saying right there, is it's really reactive, right? You're just grinding through what's right in front of you all the time. So, Tim, with that, how do you bring strategy to life to ensure that, like we just said, it's not just a plan on paper, but it's something that we can really help drive strategic execution?
So if we take if we can accept that strategy is a series of decisions that are made in real time, and the technical term is emergent strategy, let's take emergent strategy and break that into how we execute. Let's literally embrace this and say, if strategy is a decision-making science and art, so is execution. So as a leader, how do we make sure that people have an environment that we have both established and protect where great decision-making can happen? And when I work with clients and the people that I coach, that's usually one of the biggest gaps. Most organizations, in their effort to control things, have eliminated the ability for people to make great decisions. They become bureaucratic, they become dysfunctional, they become siloed, all these. So decision-making that happens usually becomes a turf war or politicized in a way that it doesn't need to be. And what happens is you generate dysfunction and ultimately massive amounts of waste. So if we think as leaders, our job is to, number one, have a really clear understanding of what the outcome is supposed to be. And then number two, create an environment where we can release our people to make great decisions. And I mean, everyone down to the front lines, that they can understand their decision impacts the clear objective we're trying to achieve. We will transform our performance. But most leaders don't really know how to do that. They were never trained on how to do strategic execution. And if you ask them, most of it was trial and error and blunt force trauma.
No, it's so true. And decision-making is so important. And being able to permeate it through the organization, because if you don't, then Tim, as a leader, either as a team leader or an organization leader, you're then the bottleneck for the whole organization, because everything kind of stops through you. So how do we come about removing some of those barriers so we can help become people, give them the opportunity to become great decision makers?
Well, let's take a moment and dig into kind of the size of the problem first. There was research done, published in Harvard Business Review, that looked at how many employees either understood or knew what the company strategy was. And that data said 95% of employees across all industries and geographies either don't understand or even know what the company strategy is.
That's amazing.
Another one was done with a company in Australia just a few years ago.
I saw that.
They actually showed people, here's a multiple choice question. Pick which one of these multiple choices are the company strategy. 71% of those employees couldn't even identify their company strategy in a multiple choice questionnaire. So when we talk about what do you do, how do you fix a mountain, right? How do you fix something that's so large? Genuinely, it overwhelms every decision that you're about to make because you don't realize how big the problem is. So I want to start there, and then I want to go down the path of, as leaders, we're not the only ones who can do this. It has to be a full team effort. Damon, I know your background in sports, love it, and go Giants. With that said, there's this huge pressure that leaders often put on themselves that they have to be the one to figure it out. And the reality is, you can't. That mountain is too big for one person to fix. It has to be something that you approach as a full organization, as a full team. So you need to bring in team thinking dynamics and team decision-making dynamics, not I'm smart, I'm talented, I'll figure it out. So let me just pause there and give you a chance to kind of jump in.
Yeah. So do you think, Tim, is it the people don't understand the strategy because the organization doesn't have a strategy, or it's changing too often, or it's just purely because it's just not crystal clear to everybody in the organization, or the organization is not doing a good job of over communicating it?
I think it's very much the latter. So really old research, you know, talks about how leaders typically under communicate by a factor of 10. You know, they get so wrapped up in their offsites and their meetings and those senior executive discussions, they get tired of hearing themselves talk. And so by the time they've made the decision, they've exhausted this for probably months in advance. And when they get to their people, here's the communication deck. Here you go. Here's your new scorecards. Let's go. And it's like, no, you really do need to spend time talking it through, give people a chance to understand it. But more importantly, what they communicate is usually not clear enough. So when I talk about where do you start specifically, point number one is clarity. And when I say clarity, I mean specifically three things. One, what's the scope of your strategy? Number two, how are we prioritizing against it? And number three, how do we ensure goal and role alignment? And let me just start with the scope one, because this is the most consistently weak leadership skill that I see. When you want to transform something, you have to generate disruption. I think of what different famous companies have done. We use Steve Jobs as an example. When he fixed Apple, when he came back, he literally turned off so many different efforts. He turned off so many different projects and business units. But what he did instead was he said, look, we're only going to do this, but I need your talents to not be wasted over there on those lower priority things. I need your talents put over here on these high priority things. So that was massive amount of disruption for everybody. Everybody's world was upside down. Either they were like, oh my gosh, I'm doing great, but now I'm in charge of all these other people who are coming and joining me that I didn't know, or my world's upside down and now I'm being pulled into this thing. And we've all been there. We've all gone through a reorg. We've all gone through a merger or an acquisition. And we've all had those experiences where our lives as we know it no longer exist. Most leaders do not know how to lead people through disruption. You have to minimize disruption. Sometimes it's not about changing everything. It's about stabilizing everything. We're a startup. We've now got to stabilize. We've got to normalize. We've got to standardize. And we've got to have some rigidity in how we do what we do. And those leaders who were great at disruption suck at stability. And they're a bull in a china shop. They're constantly breaking things. Ah, don't worry about it. We'll clean it up later. And you've got compliance controls and other financial things you're trying. Like, no, you're screwing this up. We're people are getting upset because we just told them all their scorecards, everything else has to do with stabilization. And we're not doing that. And we keep chasing after shiny objects. So that goes back to what you said about, is there a strategy? Yeah. But then depending on my understanding of that scope, that drives prioritization. And if I think, as the senior executive, I want stabilization, but I've got a bunch of transformative disruptors working for me, they're going to prioritize vastly different than I would as the senior exec. And I think that's the beginning of this horrible situation where we're seeing globally that's creating workplaces where people are stressed out, burned out, and underperforming.
Well, obviously, it's got to be involved because if you look at the Gallup study, 66% of employees, and that's just in the U.S. alone, are miserable, right?
Miserable.
They're miserable. And then I think I heard you say in Europe, it's something like 88%.
That's right.
And so so it starts with clarity, right? So it starts with at least getting everybody understanding like, okay, this is what our level of organization disruption is. Here's what, you know, the stability is. And then you kind of go from there and you help empower them. Is that the next step?
Yeah. I'll touch quickly on goal and role alignment. If you can get your scope locked in and maybe a 60-40, maybe it's 60% stabilization and 40% disruption. Let's get that clear. Let's prioritize accordingly. So this is priority one, priority two, priority three, and everybody's moving that. That dramatically improves everything. Dramatically. You add in one more touch point, and that's goal and role alignment. You start getting, look, these are our goals based against the priorities. Our job is to change our goals against the priorities, not change our priorities against the goals. And what winds up happening is groups like, I'll pick on finance because everybody does. The team in finance suddenly like changes their support for other groups because they have a goal to hit. And like, yeah, but that's not the highest priority. The highest priority, according to the strategy, is something else. If you can get that aligned, then you can empower. But again, empowerment is about how you share your assets, how you get people equipped with what they need to be successful. But if you've got groups literally changing what the goals are, moving the goalposts around, you're going to get into turf wars over who's going to get the budget, who's going to get the data, who's going to get the equipment upgrades, who's going to get the staff, because you weren't clear or you didn't reinforce your priorities and goals and roles. So it's a 1-2 punch, if I could put it that way, back to our boxing analogy. You start with clarity, you immediately follow up with empowerment. But empowerment without clarity is just waste because people are going to just burn through resources left and right.
And you're going to be fighting back and forth resources. So do you have an example, either personal or one of the clients you work with, who's done a really good job with this?
Yeah. One of my clients had a situation where their sales results were horrible. Their win rates were like 17%, and they were in a major market and just struggling, just not delivering. And the senior leader came to me and said, "Hey, I'm looking at this thing. I've got everybody in there and their cousin telling me, you know, what I should do. What do you think?" I said, well, let's look at some data. And we actually had some data on the sales pipeline. And I had an analyst on my team who went and looked at specifically where things started to break down. And we found that there was one conversation that occurred at the very beginning of the sales cycle, that when that conversation occurred, it changed the rest of the cycle. Pipeline erosion cut in half when they did that. So we dug into it and we found out. So we challenged people. We said, look, the priorities don't need to change, but your goals do. The priorities, we still want you going after the same market. We still want you talking to the same customers, same conversations, all that stuff. But your new goal is to have this conversation at the very beginning of your sales cycle. And if you don't, you will be dinged. And we made it mandatory, and it required planning to have that conversation. It was essentially a coordination conversation with the client, saying, look, thank you for engaging us. If this conversation is going to be successful down the line, we're going to need to do these X number of things. Are you ready to do that? Who will need to be involved on your side? Who will be involved from our side? All of that prep work totally smoothed out the rest of the sales cycle. When they did that, their win rate almost doubled in 3 quarters. Simply because they changed the goals and they told everybody your role must match against the goal because the priority is still the same. Then they said, okay, now how do we empower people? And we put training and coaches in place for literally 3 quarters. It wasn't you went once and you left. It was reinforced. I would show up and sit and do pipeline reviews. I would be involved in discussions with these leaders around how they're walking their teams through this change. Cause a lot of these sellers are like, oh my gosh, really? This is going to change my game. And what happened was we had frontline managers suddenly winning big deals with their teams, telling their VP, holy cow, this is amazing. And they became their own believers. And by the time they were done, that part of the world was telling the rest of their continent, you have to do it this way. If you don't, you won't get the same kind of results you're expecting. That heart and head connection was driven by what I call psychological core truths and business best practices. So you take a business best practice, like managing sales pipeline and sales process and methodology, and you add in the psychology of, let me make sure you're clear on what the expectations are, let me empower you to do it, and then let me release you to go do it. Once that release happened, people turned into their own advocates and their own champions, the culture changed, and results skyrocketed, and they became one of the highest performing groups in the world for that company.
And it's not just a sales team. It's all the way throughout the organization, right? Maybe it started with sales. But Tim, what I really like what you said right there too, is it's not just one and done, right? It's not just like, hey, let's just go in and have a whiteboard session and we're gonna talk about what the new goals are and whatever. And listeners, this is really important for you out there, all you out there who are leaders who are driving execution for any initiatives, is you have to carry it through and you have to be consistent with the communication around it and to continue to get buy-in. Because like Tim, what you said, that then once they saw some wins, then they became advocates and champions and it worked out through the whole organization.
That's right. It reminds me of the story. One of my favorite leadership stories of all time is the Wall Street Journal invited Alan Mulally to come and do an interview when he had just taken over at Ford. And they were like, oh, it's exciting. Alan, would you come and give us an interview about your strategy for the turnaround you've got planned? He goes, oh, I'd be delighted to. I'm trying to be as visible as I can in this. I'm talking about over-communicating. And he shows up. And they go, okay, what is your strategy? He goes, it's really, really simple. And he pulls out a business card. And on one side, it says One Ford. And on the other side, it had his top priorities. And they go, that's amazing. He goes, this is it. We're doing these things. If it's not these things, we're not doing it. And then the next year, Wall Street Journal says, Alan, would you please come back and share your strategy for, oh, I'd be delighted to. He goes back to year number two and they say, okay, what? And he goes, well, you know what? It's called One Ford. He pulls the same card out and they go, that was last year. He goes, no, we're not done. You don't do this in 1 year. This is a multi-year effort. We're not changing. We're going to maintain the outcome as no variability. What we do to get there is what we have to figure out. And that is emergent strategy. You figure it out as you go. It's not a plan. It's not a checklist. It's not a Gantt chart or a calendar. It is, we need to figure this out. And then once we figure it out, that will make us smarter. And then we'll use that newfound wisdom and that newfound knowledge to make ourselves even more effective as we continue to do this thing called strategic execution.
I love that. And I also love the fact you brought up Alan Mulally. Just the other day, I interviewed Craig Dowden, who co-wrote a book with him. And we talked a little bit about his, I think it's called the Working Together Strategy,
it's a system.
Now, but what I think is interesting about this, and this is in order for this to be successful though, Tim, you have to have leaders who are pretty open-minded and flexible, right? And adaptable. Because if you're stuck in either the command and control or the really fixed mindset, it's not going to work.
100% agree. This opens the door to probably the biggest part of what I do when I'm doing executive coaching. Is how do you manage what's going on in your head and what's going on in your heart? Leaders, all of them, are typically, they're smart, they're talented, they have great gifts. I've been there, but the moment they get stressed, the moment stress, pressure, some sort of negative risk pops up, we change. And we go from, psychologically or more biochemically, we go from the prefrontal cortex, the front part of our brain, where we have all this wonderful personality and problem solving and all this other stuff. And we go to our amygdala, which is the survival part of our brain. And when we do that, we stop making great decisions. We only make self-serving decisions. So it's less about, do you have the leadership skills? It's more about, can you stay neutral when pressure is on? And then from that neutral space, manage what's going on in your head and your heart so that you can continue to make the great decisions you would make if there was no pressure. But let's go to athletes. This is critical to anybody in athletics, because you can sit and look at, I just threw an interception and implode, and we've seen those quarterbacks, or you can shake it off and just do the next play and just keep it going and do what it takes to win. It's literally the biggest differentiator between good athletes and championship level athletes. And they talk so much about mindset. That's what kicked me off into this understanding for leaders, because leaders need the exact same skill set in order to make sure that they're being the best version of themselves to then inspire the people around them to be the best version of themselves. But most leaders don't even know about this.
No, it's, you bring up a good point. I mean, using a sports analogy, I played with guys when I was playing baseball who they're five tool athletes. They're incredible, but they $1 million body, 10 cent head, where you get thrown a curveball, you strike out, you're done for the day, right? You just can't recoup. And as a leader, you got to be able to have that mindset and deal with your emotions and deal with whatever's going on. So here's a question for you. What is it, because you mentioned both of them, what, in your opinion, Tim, what's the difference between pressure and stress?
Whew, that's a great question. Let me slow it down a little bit. I'm going to get real personal. In 2014, I was on vacation in Hawaii with my family, and my wife wasn't feeling good. And we thought she was sick, whatever. And then she started getting little bruises all over her body. And we were sitting at a beach and she threw up, just nothing, no other cause, just weird. So then we go to the clinic and have her checked out. And thankfully the doctor's like, it could be nothing, but I'd like you to go get a blood test right now. And I mean, right now, I literally want you to leave the clinic and go to the lab right now. Long story short, it turned out that she had acute lymphoblastic leukemia. She had cancer. And that saved her life right then, because within just a few hours, even after the lab, we went back to where we were staying. The lab results came in and they couldn't get blood. They had to use an infant needle to get blood from her finger. Because they couldn't even get blood to come out. Her blood was crashing that fast. I got stressed. I was so completely overwhelmed. For the next couple years, I didn't know what to do with myself. And that started me understanding stress, et cetera. Thankfully, the cancer went into remission and we had a few more years of chemo and all the other stuff. Life goes on. And then the cancer came back. Actually, after we just passed the 5-year mark, we thought we're good. We're on the homeward bound racetrack here, and cancer came back. And because I had learned that stress is almost always driven by fear, I took the fear out, and the greater my ability to take the fear away from the equation, the more the stress just became pressure. And so when we feel pressure in our lives, the question I ask is, what are you afraid of? And if you're not afraid of anything, I just don't know what to do. Cool. That's pressure. But the stress that I'm talking about is, oh my gosh, I'm afraid I'm going to fail. I'm afraid I'm going to do something stupid. I'm afraid of all the unknowns and the risk. And I just don't know. I go, you're pushing yourself out of prefrontal cortex into amygdala with that fear. And trust me, the decisions you're going to make, not only for you as an individual, but you as a partner, you as a parent, you as a coworker, you as a leader, you're not being the best version of yourself. So my personal journey has been, how do I find and eliminate the fear in my life? Because the fear of failing, the fear of rejection, and the fear of losing control are the triggers for me to become stressed.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that story. I know how hard it is and the grief you went through. And, you know, we talked about this before coming on camera. You know, I lost my father as well to cancer. And, you know, I mean, I dealt with a lot of that stress in the wrong ways, you know, drinking too much, eating too much. And that doesn't, you know, for our listeners out there, and this, we don't have to take it to the level that Tim and I are talking about. You know, this could be stress at work, but handling it that way, it doesn't make things better. The problems don't go away. And I think all it does is it makes it harder on yourself.
So, that's right.
And so how were you able to get better at that? Was it through maybe kind of labeling the emotions and maybe even turning to some of the resources or support that you had with you?
Yeah, it was a couple of different things. One was this personal aha moment that I had literally sitting in my living room, realizing that my stress was related to what I would call an addiction. It's the same psychology. When you talk about addiction psychology, it's the same biochemical reactions. I was addicted to success, significance, and control. I was addicted to it. The moment I had just the chance of failing or the chance of rejection or the chance of risk, I'd start, you know, freaking out like somebody was stepping on my oxygen hose. And once I understood that, I was like, okay, so my goal is to not be success or whatever. And that was part, but that wasn't really the true breakthrough. The true breakthrough came in my own personal reflection time, where I realized it wasn't about success or failure at all. It was about a question: am I doing my best? Because my best is all I can do. I call that confidence, right? So how do I go from success, failure, and shift completely into confidence mode? I'm just going to do my best. And if I'm not doing my best, hey, you know, pull up the bootstraps and keep going and, you know, turn that on. At the other hand, if I'm doing my best, that's all I can do. I might win, I might lose. That's just part of it. Same thing happened for significance versus rejection. It's not about not pursuing significance and not feeling rejected. It's about accepting who I am just as I am and loving myself. And if I can accept myself just as I am without immediately, yeah, but you still need to lose weight and you still need to, you know, da, 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 da. No, I love myself. Once I could do that, there was no fear. There's no space for it. So I didn't worry about whether or not people liked me or didn't like me or whatever. That's them, not me. And then the third one was probably the hardest one. And that was this idea of, instead of trying to be in control and not be in control and just, you know, avoiding that fear of the unknown, I learned I had to trust the journey. And I had to, like, you know what? I can't control this at all. The journey's going to be, but you know what? I got to believe the journey's going to end well. And in Diana's situation, the cancer beat her, but it didn't, right? She's gone, but she's not gone. And as much as, you know, we miss her, she's in a way better place. And because of that, that gave me the peace to kind of continue my own journey while I'm still stuck on this, you know, big blue-green rock in the middle of space. And a few years later, I met somebody new and I fell in love and found a new world opened up before me as I married my now wife, Kathy. And it's all part of the journey. And if I can trust the journey and not get freaked out when I can't see around the corner, because that's normal, I'm not afraid. And that changes not only how I live my life, it changes how I run my business, it changes how I show up at work, it changes how, and it took me a long time to figure this stuff out. But once I did, it dramatically changed even what I started looking for. And so I will say this, a very powerful resource is a book called Positive Intelligence by Shirzad Chamin. And I recommend it to everybody. And it really goes into this neutral mindset stuff. It really helps you manage your biochemistry and gives you exercises and tools and resources. The book's amazing. The program itself is even better, but it helps you slow down your biochemical response so you don't get triggered and react. What happens is you get stimulated and then you pause and then you respond. And if you react, your recovery is faster because you go, oh, wait a minute, I just reacted. Your self-awareness is out of control. It's so much better than it was. So you don't sit and spin in those negative vibrations. You're actually being who you were meant to be.
I love that. I love that. I mean, one of the things I heard you say in there was, is it Diane or Diana?
Diana. I used to say like the goddess, but yeah.
She didn't lose her battle to cancer. I mean, and I've heard a lot of people say that before. It's like, she didn't lose the battle to cancer. It's just, that's what happened. And then now she's in a better place. And I think what's so wonderful too, is you realize that you're here and you need to continue on. We had a great guest on the show, David Katz, a CEO of Plastic Bank. He lost his daughter. I don't know if you ever saw the episode. And
saw it. It was powerful. I literally was listening to him talk about that and going, oh my gosh, my heart just started pounding as I listened to his story.
Yeah. And he said, life is kind of like a roller coaster. You get on board and you have to do the very best you have to do and do your best to switch everything to look at it as a gift and reframe things. And it's such a powerful, powerful thing that he said and what you shared right here. And then going back into this part about positive emotions and slowing down and stopping, you know, from a work perspective, and also from parents, but, you know, for all our listeners out there, I think if you're going to be a great leader and an authentic leader, you have to be able to manage and do that. Because if you let your behavior and your emotions get the best of you, that's all people really see, right, Tim, is they see your emotions, right? And they want to be able to, I think leaders who are able to keep calm and keep that fear away, because that goes back to what we're saying, it helps you become a better decision maker.
Yeah. I want to add another layer that I've learned. So there's a lot of talk about safe work environments and psychological safety and all this other stuff. I've been trying to understand it because I think that gets overused and it's overplayed, and safe gets often turns into, we want to avoid all conflict and be nice. I'm going, that's not healthy.
No, it's not.
You've been on great teams. You know, when you're going to have fights with your teammates in the locker room and you're still going to go out and kick butt against whoever you're playing against. And it's, you're a great teammate, but you're going to have that energy that's not always so calm. I want to introduce a word that's also overused, and that's the word trauma. And grief, just to tie this in, grief is arguably a form of trauma, right? So when you go through something, serious grief, you're traumatized. You're feeling horrible and you don't know what to do with it. The underlying emotion for trauma is a sense of helplessness. And I think that's the most critical breakthrough that leaders, if you remember anything from this part of our conversation, it's this. When you're transparent, when you're open, if people don't feel helpless, because you were that transparent. You're doing it right. If you're melting down and they feel, oh my God, this is our boss and he's just freaking out.
Right.
You're creating trauma, my friend.
Yeah.
But there's a way to be open and honest and transparent and human in a way that says, hey, I'm with you. We're trying to figure this out together. I need your help figuring this out. But you know what? We're not helpless. And as long as you maintain that sense of we're not helpless, we're going to do our best. We're going to accept ourselves just as we are, and we'll figure it out. And then we're going to trust the journey. And we will get through this. And that injection of hope is so critical to, because when you have somebody who's going through grief and they're hopeless, there's not a lot you can do except sit with them. Just sit with them. Just be with them. Don't say anything. Just be with them. But when you're a leader and you've got people who are like, oh my gosh, I'm dealing with stuff at home. I've got stuff you don't even know about what's going on in my personal life. And now I'm at work and you're having a meltdown. You know, you're adding on top of that sense of helplessness as opposed to my life. I've got stuff going on, but when I come to work, I love it because I don't feel helpless here. And I don't know why, I don't know how, but my leader is my leader. And I love working for her. I love working for him. And I'm in. And then that opens the door to those side conversations that we all have as leaders where people start going, hey, I'm dealing with this thing at home. My kid's been really sick and I didn't want to bother anybody. And now we can come alongside and transcend the relationship from paycheck to human to human.
100%. And I think the best way to build trust is by being trustworthy yourself.
That's right.
Right. That's so true. It starts there. Talk about that a little bit.
So, you know, the whole line about, hey, trust me. Yeah, no, I can't. I can only be trustworthy. And that means I have to live in a way that you're going to choose to trust me or not. I can't force that to happen. And as consistent as I can be, and even with my mistakes, it's transparency because you'll never be perfect. The more people trust you, the more they're willing to be more visible. And if they could be more visible, now you're building trust-based accountability. But I cannot raise true accountability on my team as an example without trust as a foundation and then follow that up. And the other thing I'll throw in here, if you want more accountability on your team, start with trust without consequence. Consequences come last. Start just being, look, I'm safe, I'm real, I'm transparent, here we go. That transparency opens a door to people truly seeing what's going on. And as they start showing, hey, I messed up, I made a mistake, but you're not freaking out. So I'm going to show the other mistake I made too. And there's one more. And unless you're doing something that's going to cause them to get fired, you're like, thank you for sharing. Let's slow this down. Let's figure this out. Again, I don't want you to feel helpless because you were transparent. I want you to feel helped because you were transparent. I want you to feel like we came alongside. Another Alan Mulally story. You know, he had his big senior leaders and he had the scorecard that he would go through every week, every Thursday.
Green, red, yellow, green, 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 all the way down.
And the first person to finally put red on
that's a great story.
He applauded. There's no negative consequence. And I said, next meeting, you sit next to me because you're being the kind of leader that we need to make this turnaround possible. And his very next statement was, how can we help you? Again, it's the application of what we've just talked about in a very high level, visible business situation, lots of pressure. And he took the fear right out of it. And he said, let's make great decisions instead.
And by doing that, everybody's feel safer that they can share, right? So they're because if it's not, if they're going to get hammered by their boss or they have the fear that they're going to lose their jobs, one, they're going to only be looking out for themselves. And two, they're going to have an incredible stress that has to deal with it. And they may end up leaving anyways. But like what that story right there is like the person came forward and applauded them for showing the red. Not that people want to fail on purpose or struggle on purpose, but they're able to bring it out. And around that, then the team comes together, everybody has each other's back, and they work together, and they build a healthy environment.
That's 100% right. I work with a client, I'm going to give you a negative example. I work with a client where the leader was just constantly negative, very polite at first, but give that leader long enough, they just became critical of everything and everyone. That person doesn't know what they're doing. That person shouldn't even be here. That person is doing it wrong.
Terrible. Blah, blah, blah.
So no one felt. I'll use the word safe. No one felt confident that if they said anything, it would be heard, let alone used. So they just stopped saying anything other than what that leader wanted to hear. And you have now what you have, and he was pushing for accountability, but he was building fear-based accountability. We just talked about fear is the number one trigger for all the bad decision-making you're about to make.
That's so true. I mean, I have an similar example where you have somebody, it's just a large organization, but from the CEO, it's like it's a yes culture, and everybody has to agree with what he wants it to be. And so nobody's saying anything, right? And they all know that they have a toxic, terrible culture, and they just put up with it until they find a better place to go. And because of it, they're not taking chances, they're not innovating, they're not creative, and they're struggling as an organization.
Now, I've worked with some really big companies and some really small ones, and I can consistently point to examples where when the environment was designed to allow for, I had one leader called it robust discussion. He said, I want robust but respectful discussion. It means I want to hear the contrarian view. I want to hear the argument. I want to hear why. Let's figure it out together. When that happened, that created pressure, healthy pressure that put people in a space like, okay, if it's not A and it's not B, is it possible that we need to go after C? And all of a sudden, C is the path. We weren't seeing it. Let's pull in elements of both A and B, create a different path. Totally different dynamic than other organizations where eventually just becomes hierarchical and everybody's in survival mode trying to protect their job title slash their paycheck.
Yeah. No, it's something else. Well, I know we need to wrap it up, but Tim, this has been a wonderful conversation. You know, we talk about the difference. You know, everybody looks at strategy as being a plan, but really it's a bunch of different decisions and giving, you know, creating clarity, empowering your team to be able to go out and make those decisions and setting up an environment for them. The other thing that you brought up that I really, really like, we didn't touch on too much, is that conflict is okay. Healthy conflict is really what's important for organizations. And, you know, thank you so much for sharing the story about your wife and your personal journey with stress. And, you know, if we help one person out there with it, it's well worth the time and all of it. But where can our audience connect with you at?
The easiest place is go to timohai.com, TIMOHAI.com. And you can go there. You're going to find my channel where I have podcast and YouTube and things. You'll also find my masterclass where I actually have taken all of these best practices with strategic execution and made it a place where you can do it at your own pace. And you'll see my blog as well. Then of course, if you want to reach out to me directly, there's a link you can schedule, go right into my calendar and get a 30-minute conversation. But timohai.com.
Tim, you're awesome. And so for our listeners out there, I like to say this, but if you are struggling with execution or strategy or being clear, right? Or you know somebody that is, right? Or maybe somebody that's going through grief and they don't know how to deal with stress. What I'd like you to do is I'd like you to text this episode to somebody and say, please check this out, because I think I think we've had a wonderful conversation and I really, really appreciate you, Tim. And for our audience, let's stay curious and keep learning. Until next time, everybody. Aloha Friday. We make sure we'll put this out on a Friday for sure, right?
For
Aloha
sure.
Friday, and have a great day. Great weekend, everybody. Bye.